It is June 1st, 2012. This is Stephanie Manassas, the interviewer. I am interviewing Mr. Jerome Paul Hipp, HIPP, in Breckenridge, Minnesota. All right, Mr. Hipp, could you please tell me the date and the year that you were born?
September 12th, 1921.
Okay, so you are going to be 91 this year.
I'll be 91, yeah.
Okay. Can you tell me where you were born and raised?
I was born in Hankinson, North Dakota, and that's where I was raised.
How many children in your family?
10.
And where were you in the roundup?
I'm number 9.
Okay. Was it a farming family?
No. We lived in town.
Okay.
My dad worked on the railroad. He was a section, worked on a section for the railroad. And, well, of course, we had 3 cows and a bunch of chickens and a couple of pigs right in town. And in those days, you had all that kind of stuff. Nowadays, they don't, of course.
Okay. What did you want to do when you grew up? Did you know when you were younger?
Oh, I had no idea. I helped my brother-in-law on the farm after I graduated from high school. And then, of course, the president said, if you get your year's service in, you can quit, you know. So I joined the North Dakota National Guard out of Wapata, North Dakota, in early part of January. And then, of course, they were federalized on February 10th, 1941. And from there, we, of course, went to Camp Claiborne, Louisiana.
Okay, so you joined the National Guard in January of 1941?
Yeah.
And tell me more about the federalization. I'm not familiar with that.
Well, of course, the Guards would be a state situation, you know. And, of course, when they federalized it, it was under the federal government.
Okay.
So then we became a part of the Army, the regular U.S. Army.
And was the idea that you still had just a one-year commitment at that point?
Yes, yes.
Okay.
Now, that was Roosevelt's intention, I guess. I'm sure he probably knew more about it than I at the time. Yeah, that was it.
And so what were you doing for the National Guard?
Well, I was a private, of course, at that time, a rifleman, plain old GI rookie, you know. And, yeah, you trained as a rifleman is what you did. In Camp Claiborne, we trained primarily all the time. And, then, of course, I was put in the 60-millimeter mortar, the 4th platoon of the company. I don't know what else I could tell you.
And where is Camp Claiborne?
Camp Claiborne is right out of Alexandria, Louisiana.
Okay.
How far out, I don't know. A few miles. And we stayed there till, of course, we were trained there all the time until December 7th happened, you know. And then we went, shortly after that, we went to Idaho and Montana and guarded railroad tunnels, railroad bridges, things like that, in case of sabotage, you know. I'm sure it was just a precaution.
Can you tell me more about Pearl Harbor Day, what you remember?
No, nothing other than the fact that we just disassembled everything at the camp and intended to go out to San Francisco, I guess. Of course, we didn't at the time. We went to Montana and Idaho for just a short time. That didn't last very long because it was real good duty. One thing I do remember of that, we ate at a farmhouse, in the morning, this gal had fried potatoes and bacon and or ham and toast and eggs and all that. But, you know, we never ate like that in our lives, you know. So that was real good duty. But, of course, like I said, it didn't last long.
Was that farm that where you remember the breakfasts, was that in Montana or Idaho?
No, that was in Montana.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Where in Montana?
Well, I can't
Idaho?
Remember that.
Okay.
We were our company was stationed at Sand Point, Idaho.
Okay.
That's where we were stationed at. We took over a CC camp. It used to be in Sand Point, Idaho, and our company lodged in that particular area. And then we went out. That was our headquarters, and then from there we went to Idaho and Montana, different members of the company, you know. Yeah. And then from there we went to Fort George Wright, which would be near Spokane, Washington. It was an airfield. We guarded the airfield for a little while. And that didn't last long either, just a few days and stuff. And then we went from there to Fort Ord, California. Got our shots, you know, for overseas employment, and then shipped out from San Francisco.
When did you ship out from San Francisco?
I would have to be the... it would have to be the first part of 1942, in March probably.
Okay.
Because we went from there to, we went on the President Coolidge, was an ocean liner, and on our convoy was President Coolidge and the Queen Elizabeth and the Mariposa. That was the three ships that were on our convoy. And we went to Melbourne, Australia, and unloaded off of there onto three smaller ships because... We were going to New Caledonia, and they didn't have a harbor large enough for the Coolidge to get into, so they loaded onto three smaller ships.
In Australia.
And then we went to New Caledonia and trained there, you know, and primarily unloaded supply ships that would come in, primarily 55-gallon drums of aviation gas is what we unloaded, and you would take 15 barrels on a GI truck. But handle those barrels of 55-gallon barrels of gasoline. We were in good shape when we left New Caledonia for Guadalcanal. I'll tell you, we were in good shape. That was hard work, but it was good for us, I'm sure. It ended up being good for us.
And tell me more about your training in New Caledonia.
Well, it was just a matter like I say, most of the time we were unloading ships is what we were doing. You know, very, very little rifle training, you know, because we had that all... Previous at Claiborne, same situation.
Okay. And how long were you in New Caledonia?
Well, it must have been the fore part of March, I suppose, we got into that area. And we were there until we went to the canal, Guadalcanal, and we landed there October 13th,
okay.
1942.
Okay. So tell me what happened when you got to Guadalcanal.
The what?
Tell me what happened when you got to Guadalcanal.
Well, that we unloaded our ship, when we got there, and we got shelled immediately from the Japanese. Artillery opened up on us, and then the Japanese Navy came in that night and bombarded the airfield. And luckily enough, we were on the beach, and the airfield was, you know, like, say we were on a beach here, and we were laying here, and the airfield is over here. So they were firing over towards the airfield, Luckily, they didn't ferret get us, you know. Everything was over us. They bombarded that for at least 2.5 hours. The battleships and cruisers. In fact, they did that for 2 or 3 nights in a row. They were trying to knock out the airfield. And then from there on, the Japanese attacked on Longa Point. They attacked it, and of course we went up onto the lines that were there. The Marines had lines that they had formed a perimeter around the airfield, you know, to protect the airfield. And of course the Japanese attacked it on that particular area. And our battalion was sent into that area. And I was in the 60mm mortars and stuff, so of course we fired a lot of shells and stuff. And it was a pretty tough time. And luckily I didn't get killed or get hurt, so that was a good deal. And then from there we went to another attack that happened on Matanico Ridge. And that's where we lost quite a few guys. And then we left the island in March, sometime in March, I think it was 1943. And we went to Bougainville, which is in the Northern Solomons. And we landed there Christmas Day. And I don't know who relieved on the line, but we went right on the line. They had a perimeter again, protecting an airfield. They didn't take the whole island at that time. They just take a certain area of the island and form a ring around it, you know, and protect the airfield. That was the main purpose of most of these island hopping, they called it. Most of the reasoning was to protect the airfields so we could bomb different islands in different areas. And we were on Bougainville. The Japanese hit the regiment next to us on the line. I think it was the 132nd Regiment, if I remember right. But we our 60 mortars helped fire that area for protecting, help them protect in the attacked, and we repulsed it. And I just don't know how long we were on Bougainville. We were on Bougainville quite a while, and then from there we went to the Philippines.
So you arrived in Bougainville on Christmas Day?
Christmas Day of 43.
43.
Yeah.
And then?
Well, see, from New Caledonia, or from Guadalcanal, we went back to the New Hebrides.
Okay.
Not New Hebrides. What was that island? This island was went from New Caledonia to Guadalcanal back to the Fiji Islands. Excuse me.
Okay.
Wasn't the New Hebrides. Fiji Islands. We went there after we left Guadalcanal, we went to the Fiji Islands.
Okay.
And we regrouped and naturally took on more replacements because of the fellows we lost, wounded from malaria and whatever, you know. And then we regrouped there and trained some more. Naturally, you train all the time. Wherever you go, you train. So you get more efficient. So you get more efficient with that 60mm mortar, you know. And then from there, of course, we went to Bougainville. And then from Bougainville, we went to the Philippine Islands. We landed on Leyte, and I don't remember when we landed on Leyte. It had to be sometime in 43, I suppose. And I don't remember gaining fighting with the Japanese in on Leyte. We did a little bit of it on the island of Cebu, and then we went from there to landed on Negros, one of the islands. Didn't come any Japanese there. And then we went to Mindanao as reinforcements, you know. But we didn't run into any Japanese there either. Apparently, we didn't have to be. So then they came with they had the point system going. If you had for each year you were in the service, you got 1 point, and for each month, each month you were in the service, you got 1 point, and each month you were overseas, you got 2 points. So if you had 100 points, they would start rotating you back to the States. And of course, I had over 100 points, so they started rotating us back from Leyte to the United States. And I went home on a Liberty ship. They were built by Kaiser in those days. Anyway, we were on the high seas coming home. It took us 30 days to come home from the Philippines to San Francisco. But while we were coming home, they dropped the first atomic bomb on Hiroshima. And then, of course, they dropped a second one shortly. Anyway, we stopped at Pearl Harbor and took on fresh water in this boat. And then we started out for the United States. And I remember the captain of the ship remarking about, it came over the PA system. He said there'd be no smoking cigarettes or anything at night because we know the war is over, but the Japanese submarines probably don't know that the war is over. So we came home. It took us, I think, 10 days to come from Pearl Harbor to San Francisco. And from San Francisco, they took us across to what they call Angel Island. I don't know if it's still Angel Island or what. But anyway, they had fresh milk and all the fruit and everything you could possibly imagine, you know, that you could have. And they kept us there a couple of days, and then we went to Fort Lewis, Washington, and they discharged us. So that's my history.
Mr. Hip, can you tell me when you were in boot camp in Louisiana, do you have any memorable stories at all?
Yeah. The one thing I remember about Woody Keeble was in our company. He eventually got the Congressional Medal of Honor, by the way. And one of the members of Company I had gotten the mumps, and they quarantined the whole company. So some of the guys had gone from camp to town, you know, which they weren't supposed to do, and stuff. And anyway, I was on KP that day and stuff. Anyway, I got off KP, and the sergeant of the guard came, and he said, "Hip, you got to go on guard duty because there aren't enough guys left in the camp." Well, I said, "I just got off special duty, you know." He said, "It'll make any difference. You got to go on guard duty." So of course our camp was we lived in permeable tents, and there were five guys in a tent. Of course, they were made out of wood, the tents deals. Anyway, 3rd Battalion headquarters was like here. Row, and then our row started here. The company's row started the tents, okay? Anyway, I got stationed in the middle of the row. And I don't know what time of night, probably 2 o'clock or whatever it happened to be. Here comes Keeble and another guy from town, and they said, "Hip, don't call the corporal of the guard or nothing, because, you know. And I said, Woody, and he looked like he was about 18 feet tall. Husky Indian, you know. Nice fellow. Anyway, I said, Woody, it doesn't make any difference. I said, they took bed check and they know who's out. So there's no sense in that. And while I was trying to discuss this with him, the sergeant of the guard came around through the tent, so I was free. But anyway, that's the one thing I remember about Camp Claiborne. Anyway, then they made these guys every day go to the PX and smash beer cans. And, of course, they would have to come back to our company for chow, to feed them. And, of course, Woody'd see me and he'd shake his fist at me. That's one of the things I remember about Camp Claiborne, I'll tell you that.
Because he thought you got him in trouble.
Yeah. But it was just a matter of time, and of course they left him go. It was no problem. They couldn't do him anything, you know. And that was about it. We trained every day. Went out in the fields near Camp Claiborne and stuff. Swampy area is what it was, you know. I think they had two camps that I remember: Camp Claiborne and Camp Polk, Louisiana. I don't remember. Anyway, I think they it was a good idea to place these camps in the swampy area of the country. I wasn't in love with Louisiana, I'll tell you that. And that's about it.
How well do you think it prepared you for your actual combat?
Oh, the training was good. We had good non-commissioned officers, and they did a good job. We had a good captain and good lieutenants. Yeah, they were nice guys. They trained us well. I can't say they didn't, yeah.
So how long were you in Australia then before you went to New Caledonia?
We weren't in Australia, I don't imagine, probably over 4 or 5 days, that's all. Just time enough to unload this big ship that, mm-hmm. that President Coolidge was at that time the largest cargo and passenger ship in the world, I think. But they had, that ship was so huge that they could open they had side doors on the ship, on the sides, that they opened up. So you could go in the ship not from the top, but from the side. So you can imagine how large it was. It was a big ship. And fact of the matter, we ran into quite a storm before we got to Australia. And some of the scuttlebutt was that there was a submarine chaser. They called them submarine chasers at that time. It was a small boat that could attack the submarine, I suppose, if they had to. But anyway, they came to meet us, you know, to take us on into the harbor. And the storm was so bad that they came in a day later after we were in the harbor. So it was a pretty good storm. And of course, our ship was big enough to take care of it. But those are things you remember, you know. This had to be on the Philippines. Yeah. It's on the Philippines. Anyway, there were some nips, some Japanese quite a ways, about 1,000 yards out. And we started firing mortars on, you know. So some of the guys went on the upper part of the hill. Mortars are below the hill, naturally. And they went up on the top part of the hill to watch the shells landing on near those nips, you know. And of course, Swede Manson, one of the guys was in our platoon. He was a squad leader of their particular group of guys. And they were up in there watching and stuff. And of course, the Japanese sneaked up with a machine gun and of course fired on him. And of course, hit this kid. In the legs, yeah. Anyway, yeah, they we carried him back, and then I got his flight jacket, and I put it on, wrapped it up, and made a pillow out of it. And he said to me, "God damn it, Hip," he said, "I beat rotation anyway." He'd gotten hit, you know. That was his comment. That was his comment. Yeah.
And so how badly was he wounded?
Well, he had a brace on his... He recovered. And, of course, he had a brace on his leg all his life.
He did.
He's passed away now. Yeah. Yeah, he had a brace on his leg all his life. Any funny stuff? Well, when we were on Bougainville, I remember this. There was a kid from Hankinson by the name of Joe Bierenbaum. He was in the Seabees, and they were on Bougainville also. And I found out that they were there and stuff. And of course, he said to, for some reason, we got to go back to their area and stuff. And then he asked his commanding officer if us guys could stay for supper, because the Seabees ate good. You know, they had reefers and where they could keep fresh meat and things like that, you know. And so we had a real good supper at this place. And then Joe Bierenbaum said, one of the officers in the medical outfit, their Jeep had in trouble, so these guys fixed it for him so the Jeep could go. And this medical officer gave him 2 quarts of alcohol. It was, I suppose it was medical alcohol, but it was, you know, fit to drink. What the heck, you know? So he gave us one of those jugs to take along back to the company. So, of course, the 4th Platoon. 4th Platoon was lucky enough to be able to have a highball that night.
So you guys actually drank it.
Oh, sure. It was good. There was nothing the matter with it. Yeah. So, I suppose it was regular alcohol, you know, the 190 proof alcohol. But that was about it. Anyway, we went to the company kitchen and got some grapefruit juice. Mixed it with grapefruit juice. It was good anyway. It did the trick. That's one thing I remember about that area. And what was it? What else was it? Oh, yeah, Bob Hope, I think, came. Bob Hope came to that area to do his entertaining. And we had to go from the lines. We were on the lines. We had to go down. You had to walk down to the way down to the beach area, you know, because that's where he performed. And you had to. I don't know how many hours it took to get there, and how many hours it took to sit there while he did his thing, you know. It wasn't something that we needed for morale, I can tell you that, but then it was something that they did.
Was that in Bougainville? Or?
It was on Bougainville.
Did you just not enjoy it that much?
Well, I suppose it was the fact that you had to probably donate 4 hours of your time and in the heat and sweat and everything else to listen to some guy try and tell you some jokes, you know. It wasn't my cup of tea anyway. And I'm sure it probably was a morale builder for some people, maybe, you know. This was, in the Philippines, we were on some, well, they send you out on areas, certain areas to see if there are Japs there or something, you know. Anyway, when we were coming back to our particular area, we went past a pineapple patch, you know. So the guys just broke rank and went into the pineapple patch and grabbed a bunch of it. It was hot. And ate it, you know, and stuff. And then the battalion came, these farmers, I suppose, or whomever owned this, complained to the battalion. The battalion came back to Company I, and we He had to pay. Each guy had to throw in a few dollars, it was, to pay for those pineapples. So it was something that you did. Yeah. That's,
so your brother, you and your brother met in Bougainville. Is it a Bougainville?
Bougainville. Okay, it was Bougainville, yeah.
Bougain, I don't know.
So how many of your brothers were in World War II?
No, just this one.
And did he make it out alive?
Yeah.
That's good.
He ended up in New Zealand and in the... he ran a lumber camp, a lumber yard for many, many years. They supplied lumber to whomever, you know. It was good duty. They went from there to... I don't remember where they went from there. John, they came up further up, but where, I don't remember.
So tell me more about when you came to Guadalcanal. Were you guys, did you know that you'd be under fire immediately when you got there?
Oh, I'm sure we did, yeah. Because we were unloading ship, excuse me, we were unloading ship, you know, and stuff, and they fired onto the beach even while we were unloading ship. The Japanese artillery, and of course we had no idea that they. But now, when you read back how strong the Navy was, the Japanese Navy, that is, I'm surprised that we even were able to reinforce that place. You know, because when you read the history of it now, how strong the Japanese Navy really was, and even the fact that they didn't expect that island to be saved, you know, they didn't expect us to, and I guess we didn't realize it was that dangerous. As what you read nowadays, you know, about it. And probably it was a good thing we didn't.
Mm-hmm. What else do you remember about Guadalcanal?
Well, it was a pretty tough situation. It was nothing good about it. But I was lucky enough to not get malaria. I was lucky enough to not get malaria. I don't know, it must have been the good Lord saved me, I guess. That's all I can say. It wasn't a good situation. It was bad. I only remember one time this Louis Dibbert I'm talking about. They were, some of the guys were, we had what they call lockers, steel lockers. They were just kind of trunks, where you kept your clothes and all that stuff, okay? Anyway, you'd put a blanket on this trunk and then shake dice, you know? Anyway, Louis was shaking dice one time, and so I bet a buck or whatever it was, and I was in the game anyway. Anyway, he said to me, "Hip," he said, get off of me, because he said, "You won't win." And Louis would shake the dice, you know, and he had a good way of doing it. He'd always win. You know?
He'd always win?
he said, "Get off of me, because you can't win."
So he was a
That's
good
what I remember about Louis. He was a good guy, you know.
Yeah.
He was a good soldier, darn right. Yeah. And of course, he got killed. I think he was a corporal at that time. And that was on that Matanikau, when we crossed that Matanikau River. And they fired mortars, and I think these guys went over this hill, and there was a drop-off and stuff, and the Nips had had a crossfire, machine guns crossfired, and of course, when they dropped off this ridge and stuff, they didn't have a fight chance to get back up, you know. So, of course, they got killed. I'm sure they were killed instantly.
Was that a sad day for you when you found out that he was killed?
Well, we didn't find out until later on, of course. We were in the mortars and stuff. And we fired a lot of mortars that day. Yeah, that's all.
So what do you wish that the younger generation knew about World War II?
Well, I really don't know. The younger generation nowadays, it's hard to figure out what's to be happening. The world situation, you know. You don't know, like the situation right now in Afghanistan and stuff, these poor guys don't know who their enemy is. You know, at least we knew who our enemy was, you know. If there was somebody up ahead of us, you knew it was enemy. These guys don't know where the enemy is. In the first place, in the second place, I shouldn't even be going into this, but in the second place, I'm not a firm believer we got any business over there. These countries have to start learning to take care of themselves. Come on, what's the point? What makes us think we can constantly keep giving these people billions and billions and billions of dollars? For what? Make any sense.
Mr. Hip, any other stories around your World War II experience that you want to share?
No. That's all I know of.
Okay. Thank you very much for your time today.
You're welcome.